I miss all of the ideas that I don't have.
It was very surprising to me that I didn't feel lonely doing this job, and I think that that has two main reasons. One is that my writing is very social.
Thanks for listening to WorkWise, the growth mindset for wisdom at work. I'm Ken Kennard, coach and chief creative officer at Accent Interactive, and I'm joined by Michael Boies from Credo Consulting. Today we have two guests join us for the topic of freelancing, and you'll get to hear from their perspective on what it's like to be freelancing in today's marketplace. So Mike, in medieval times, if you were a warrior, if you were like a guy with a sword,
a squire or a knight or something.
Yes. And if you were really good at killing people, then you would have a lot of job security. You'd be like totally set as long as your lord was at war.
Right.
Right.
But what do I do if he's not at war?
Well, see, that's the question. I mean, you're sort of all dressed up and nowhere to go at that point. So what do you do? So what are your options?
Well, I think I would probably go around inciting hatred and animosity and feuds between rival lords so that I could ply my trade.
No, that's going to get you in trouble, and that's morally reprehensible.
Oh. Oh. So what do I have options?
So here's what you could do.
Instead of being morally reprehensible.
Yes.
Okay.
What you could do is you could say, hey, I could offer up my services. I mean, I've got this lance here, right?
Yeah.
I could offer up my lance to some other lord who's at war and say, look, you obviously need what I offer. Why don't you hire me?
Oh, so I'd like be a free lancer.
Right.
But I'm not going to get very far if I'm for free.
But you're not free in that sense. You're not working for free. You're freely on the market.
Ah,
so you're just like, see how
I could go wherever I want to.
Exactly.
With my great skills.
Freedom. Yes. Have lance, will travel.
Oh.
So that's in the medieval times. Of course, in the United States, nobody would do this, right? Because in the last several hundred years, what's the morally right thing to do? What's the safe and secure thing to do? You get a job is what
yeah.
you do.
Yeah. You move to the city and you work for the man somewhere and you have a stable job. Even if it's boring and there's nowhere to go, but you have a stable job where you can go to.
It buys you a lot of things.
Yeah. Unless, of course, you're living somewhere past the mid to late 80s.
And then what do you do?
Well, then your stable, boring, unfun job isn't so stable anymore because
you can change it. Go work for someone else.
Yeah. But what if your mindset is, well, I've been geared to work for this one employer and I was guaranteed this work all my life. And so I need all the stability. What do you do then?
Right. Well, here's what I learned an interesting thing about this
okay.
recently. So between 2010 and today, there's been a
right.
big shift. In 2010, 12% of the American workforce was what they call contingent. Now,
right.
contingent, what does that mean? That's freelancers, part-timers. There's all kinds of words for this. Like.
Right. Or free agents.
Free agents, yes,
yeah.
exactly. Contracted workers, temp workers.
Independent consultant.
Yes. So we've gone from 12% in 2010 to 20% now of the work. And it's
in
on the
like
rise.
6 years.
Yeah, and it's keep on moving.
Wow, yeah. And I read somewhere recently, I believe the number was we're expecting it to hit 40% in by like 2020 or something around that time frame.
Okay. So a bunch of workers are going to be changing the nature of the way that
right.
they work. So
right.
I'm curious about that. I think that's a major shift.
It's huge for everybody.
Now, I think about freelancing. What do you think of when you think of freelancing? I think of, hey, I can work from home in my bunny slippers.
Right. Well, I have this objection to that.
What's that?
Well, I'm just not a bunny slippers kind of guy. If I were to wear slippers, it'd be more like leopard or cheetah slippers.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Oh, you're kind of ferocious. I bet your slippers could eat my slippers for lunch.
I think they are a pet.
I wondered where my slippers went.
Well, if you take a close look at my feet, you'll notice there's a mix of kind of cheetah fur.
Why don't you show your feet to the listening audience?
I will show them to you. I'm going to hold it right up to the mic.
Oh, Mike, put that away. Oh, that's...
But you saw it, didn't you?
That's disgusting. I'm sorry I asked.
So my bunny slippers ate... I mean, my cheetah slippers ate your bunny slippers because they're more nimble and ferocious and they're attacking things.
Well, I'm really glad to know what happened with that. And I'm also very curious about what people are doing now in this shift. What is their lifestyle really like? And so I did something for you, Mike.
You did?
Yes.
You're always doing things for me.
I know. What I did was I went to find out. I actually interviewed a couple of these people who are doing this, who are living this freelance work lifestyle.
And where'd you find them?
I found them in New York City, of course. Oh. Where else would you
Silly
find?
Silly me. Of course. New York's the city.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
And what a great environment for finding independently minded workers.
Yeah. And there's so much talent and so much going on there.
Yeah. Exactly. So, all right. So what I want to do is I want to play you some of the interviews.
Right, right.
And then maybe we can talk about it.
Sure,
okay.
Sure.
So first of all, let me introduce who's being interviewed.
Fantastic.
Tell you a little bit about him.
Good.
Number one, we have Megan Ritchie. Now, Megan is a curator, a writer, a publisher, and a consultant. Okay.
It's a lot.
She's directed communications and managed projects for arts nonprofits. She's consulted with artists and arts organizations internationally and is sought after for everything from fundraising and event planning to branding and PR.
So she's got some chops.
Yeah, exactly. Now, and not only that, she publishes The Curator Magazine, which I don't know if you're familiar. It's a daily online.
Daily?
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Daily online magazine that's at the intersection of cultural artifacts and human flourishing. That's my definition.
Gotta check it out. Yeah. Gotta check it out.
So I spoke with Megan. You'll hear this in the interview. We are on a grassy hill overlooking the Statue of Liberty. This is from Brooklyn.
Did you have like a checkered blanket out too?
No, we couldn't find a checkered blanket. But if we had one, we would have used it. It was actually kind of cold that day.
you could have used a blanket.
Totally. The next person is April Green. April is a freelance writer and editor. She has experience working in publishing in Boston. She was a bartender in Ireland. She's taught English in Japan, and she's done fundraising for arts nonprofits in Brooklyn.
So she's been around too,
yeah,
and in a different way than Megan.
Right.
Yeah.
Now she is. I interviewed her. You'll tell from the interview. It's kind of at a coffee shop, bookstore kind of environment. Okay. So you'll hear that.
And you were warm there.
Plenty warm.
With your coffee.
Exactly. Exactly. So anyway, so would you like to hear some of these interviews?
I can't wait.
All right, so let's start with Megan. So I asked Megan about why she got into freelancing and why did she say yes to this and what did it offer her?
For a variety of reasons, because I wanted to work alongside the people who approached me about them, because I knew that I could see a need, I could see where the things that I could offer could really help an organization that was stuck. Improve. I'm thinking of some of the smaller regional arts nonprofits that I would dip into and like help them restructure their communication scheme or help them look at how they were utilizing their volunteers or resourcing their volunteers. I knew that I could do it, and I knew that the folks that were asking me were asking because they thought that I could do it, and so I said yes. And also because I enjoyed it. Like some of the freelance curatorial work that I said yes to, I've curated 5 or 6 visual art exhibitions in the last 2 years. That has very much been just like trying to keep my hat in the ring of visual arts curation. So like in that case, I did that strategically. But with the other stuff, it was more because I knew that I could. I had the capacity, I had the time, and I cared about the people. So I said yes.
Yeah, so it's interesting that you're a curator and you use this word cobbling together your career. And what connections do you see between being a curator and your career choices as you're bringing these different opportunities together into one kind of thing?
Well, what curators do is they look at a really large body of work from a specific time or of a specific concept or made with specific materials or from specific regions. I mean, there's any way that you can narrow a body of work. And then they perceive what would most effectively communicate to an audience about that body of work. So they take something large and then they narrow it down and they create a space for that exhibition to thrive, and they create language to help an audience understand. I mean, they do other things too, but like those are kind of the big. And so that's not dissimilar from what I had to do when I looked at the landscape of employment opportunities or projects. I had, you know, I could see what was out there, and then I thought what it would be if I'm thinking of my own vocation as an exhibition, what opportunities most effectively communicate about what I can do so that more opportunities can come. So I guess like you're exhibiting yourself when you're a freelancer, which is not dissimilar from putting together an exhibition.
She's exhibiting herself.
Yes. Yeah. And that's a huge kind of insight and in a approach to work. But she said other than, so it's self-expression, right?
Right.
And she said, not only that, but she said, like, I have to manage my career long-term, but I also have to manage this stuff and the different parts I want now in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a curator's approach.
Yeah.
But isn't it interesting to hear a young lady say, I have to manage my career and what I put into it so that I can get out of it what I want long term.
Yeah. And I thought it was interesting also that she was kind of mission minded. Did you notice that?
She didn't
say, oh yeah, this is going to be better for me financially. Or
no,
this
not
is
at
where
all.
This is going to lead to another opportunity. So I'm going to take this. It was
never
more like,
came up.
She was like, I think I could help these people.
Yeah.
These people that I know and care about, and I care about what they're doing. I think I could have a positive impact in this mission.
And there was so much relationship there. And there was, it sounded like, and you were there talking to her, but it sounded like the first statement about that was she wanted to work alongside these people.
Yes.
And then she migrated to this idea, I can help them. Yeah. I have something to add to them. But there's also a hint of, I can learn something from them and I want to be with them and I care about them. All kind of mixed up in a bundle.
Yeah, right.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. And she did not start her career freelancing. So she developed those relationships as an employee.
Right.
And then after developing that network, she had all these relationships that she cared about. And I imagine her kind of cherry picking from the relationships and the opportunities.
Yeah.
This one makes good sense for me and that one doesn't.
And it really illustrates this idea that you and I talk about a lot, which is work's a big part of our life.
Yeah.
And I think freelancers just show that more than ever. But our relationships are so bound up in our work and our self-expression is so bound up in our work. And it seems like she's just saying, you know, like this was just a perfect way for me to do work because of those things. I feel it in my soul.
Yeah. You know? Right. Yeah. So one of the other questions I have is about where people work, like the space in which they work. And I think it's really important. I think space actually affects how well we can concentrate, what kind of work comes easy, what kind of work is hard. Are you fighting your space?
What kind of mood you're in?
Yes.
What your mind is?
Exactly. So it's really important.
This is something you've been thinking about for a lot of years now.
Right, right. Yeah. And so when I had the chance to design a space,
yeah.
you know, I thought
look at it.
You know, here we are in that space. You know, the values that I have are reflected
right.
in the space because I got a chance to design it. So these are people in New York City. So I was curious to know, I mean, the built environment is everywhere. It's mostly a built environment. Where do they work? So I want to play you a clip from April who talks about that, where she's working, what works for her. Let's listen to that.
I typically work in my living room. I work on a stand-up desk that my boyfriend and I built into the wall. So there's a keyboard on top of a speaker, and then there's a monitor on top of a shelf, and I do that. I sometimes will sit on the couch with my laptop or it's pretty much actually the only places in my apartment that I work in. I will occasionally work in a coffee shop, maybe once a week for a couple hours. I most often find them too loud, mostly just the music, not even the people, but I just really like quiet to be able to concentrate and stay organized and everything. I did adopt the rule of getting dressed every day after last winter when we had some of those hellishly cold days, and I did just stay in my pajamas, and then by the end of the day I thought this is awful and demoralizing and I have to get dressed. So I do make a rule to do that, whether or not I'm slated to leave the house. Although now I also have a rule that I leave the house at least once a day, because there's no guarantee that I'll leave. I have client meetings maybe once or twice a week outside the apartment, but there's almost always one day where it wouldn't be necessary for me to leave, so I just make myself leave at some point and take a walk around the block or something at least. But yeah, space is so personal to work, and I think that, you know, writing is so famously a solitary activity, or it is almost all the time. And the peace and quiet of home is perfect for me for that. And I really don't miss being in an office. I just go out a lot and see my friends other times, and I keep up with my colleagues in other ways, and it's fine.
So Ken, when I listen to April, it just sounds like a, kind of a classic movie scene from New York. Some hipster,
yes,
working from home, heading out somewhere, but you know, this cool micro apartment,
yes,
that you've kind of maximized the value of every nook and cranny.
I love it that the keyboard's on the speaker,
monitor. Yeah, and they made the shelf that flips up, yeah, it sounds like. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome, but it sounds so hip and cool, right?
Yes.
It's interesting. It's just really interesting to hear this is how this person's thriving, to her surprise.
Right.
Because she didn't have all those connections that she so endeared in the workplace.
Yes.
So tell me, your impression of her. I'm curious, yeah, is would you have predicted, you know, from meeting her and knowing her a little bit, that this is how she would really enjoy working?
Well, I expected her to say that she has found these nooks and crannies in the city that really work for her.
Right.
And in fact, the nook and cranny that she's found is in her apartment, that she's just, I imagine there's a lot of efficiency there, right?
Yeah.
Nowhere to go, full control of the space and so on. And you know, something I learned from Megan is that in New York City, a lot of the public space can actually be more private, and some of the private spaces can seem more public because you're in an apartment with windows and people can see across the next building. So you're looking into people's apartments all the time if the windows are open. And yet you can be in a public place like a park and not see anybody for hours
and
have a little bit more of an isolation.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So,
it was kind of cool how they designed the little spot though, too. Like,
yeah,
it wasn't just the apartment, but that it sounds like they probably created like a swing out shelf where she can, mm-hmm, put her stuff, her laptop on it.
And she's standing. She's standing to work.
That's right. She's standing. Yeah. So she doesn't have to be a desk.
Right.
And so she's created that little space for her in her home.
Yeah, and she sits on the sofa and she does go to the coffee shop. But a lot of the writing, I imagine, she's doing at home.
Yeah, yeah. But she gets out.
She does.
And she makes sure
she feels like she needs to get out.
I can relate with that.
Yeah.
I can relate. You know, I'm a small business and I'm virtual. So the people I work with are affiliates.
Yeah.
You know, we work together.
Right.
But they're not in my office with me. I work out of the home in my home office. And I have affiliates I work with, and we, you know, so my wife often tells me, get out of the house, go somewhere, get some energy.
Right.
Somewhere else.
Right. So how about for you? What kind of work do you do at home versus what kind of work do you do somewhere else? Does it change or?
Well, I do a lot of administrative things at home.
Yeah.
And I find that I get when I have too much of that, I get in the doldrums. And when I was driving today, I had just met with somebody. And some new things were happening, and I'm driving and I'm getting excited. And I find in the office, if I'm coming off like a week away, I love a day or two in the office to just recenter, take care of things, get out of the hubbub and kind of relax. But then I'm bursting to get out.
Yeah.
I need to get out and see people to re-energize and to
put
me outward. And,
sure.
And so you need a balance. And she says that she's figuring out how to make that happen. She's designing it.
Right. Yeah, I was curious to ask Megan about this because a curator is a person who cares a lot about space.
Yeah.
And so I was just curious, like, well, how would she create her own space?
Curate,
what is for she her own know? Work.
Let's hear it.
Yeah, I'm productive in different ways in different spaces. So when I'm working from home, which can be really nice because you're not wasting time getting to a place, you're just able to start. That's great. So I try to spend a few hours at home every morning just attending to really immediate needs. But more often than not, if I'm working from home all day, I am distracted by like house duties. I just really like doing housework. I like cooking. I like cleaning. And I end up letting that interrupt me. So I have to be in public. And it can even be a really, really rowdy public space. If I can't get up and go do something else, that's really good for me. So there's lots of coffee shops in the neighborhood that I go to. I go to the public library because it's quiet, so I usually will write there. I've tried co-working spaces, but for me, the benefit hasn't been the cost. The cost hasn't outweighed the benefit of just like working at a coffee shop. Maybe if I was working with a team of people, then a co-working space would make more sense. But for me, what I'm doing alone, just being out in public works. I had been living in a cellar apartment, which was huge and had really great workspace that I always did really well in. And then I moved to this new apartment in Brooklyn that had just basically all windows. And so I didn't realize what a difference the light made about my mood. And it actually helped me to just be a more optimistic worker, which was refreshing. So now I know that that's something.
Did it also have a downside to it, the windows and the outlook?
Not that I found yet.
Okay.
It's been really nice to just have like good natural light. The downside of working in your home is just like isolation, you know. You're working alone. You really are. You don't have the colleague to like. I'm on the phone a lot and I take lots of meetings, but yeah, you are alone. You're also incredibly efficient. Like, there's just not anyone to interrupt you, really. So you can get the amount of work that I used to get done in a collaborative office space. Where it used to take me 8 hours there, I can do in 4 hours from home, which is good because then you can do more work. But it's also just odd that you cannot look away from your screen for 4 hours and then be like, oh, maybe I should listen to a podcast or something or blink. Really? Because there's no one to say, it's kind of weird that you haven't moved in 4 hours.
For 4 hours, your eyes are bleeding.
Right. Yeah, I thought that was really insightful, just in terms of she knows herself, she knows the different spaces, what the options are, and really values that alone time because she can be so much more productive. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I don't think everyone really gets how in an office environment, how distracting it can be.
Yeah.
To have so much, to be so interruptible, to have an environment where everyone's sharing space and sound and just, you know, how does anyone get anything done is the feeling that I have when I go into one of those spaces after being alone and being so productive.
Right. I'm so productive. Yet I feel isolated and disconnected.
Yes.
But what's interesting to me is what kind of what you said. I mean, like is that, which distraction will you choose?
Mm.
Right? You're in the workplace and you're distracted by other people, other conversations, other things going on, your friends upstairs, right? So you get distracted by those things. And at home, she wasn't distracted by things that weren't important. She was distracted by other things to do.
Laundry, cleaning, cooking.
Right. It wasn't like she was playing.
Right.
But she was distracted by other things she enjoyed that were important to her.
Yeah.
And she decided that she needed to manage that.
Yes.
You know, Ken, I've been thinking.
That's good.
I've been thinking that I listen to podcasts and they have sponsorships.
Why don't we have a sponsor?
That's a good question. Have you called your mom lately?
Yeah.
She might sponsor us.
I think she listened to one of my episodes too.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Do you think she could do it?
No. Mm. She doesn't want to sponsor a podcast.
Mm. Do you think we'd get anybody else to do it?
Maybe.
I have an idea.
What?
You're a big fan.
I'm one of my biggest fans.
You are. You are one of your own biggest fans, and you're one of my biggest fans.
Okay. What are you going to do? You're going to sponsor me, and I'm going to sponsor. What is this? Where are you going with this, Mike?
Well, we're sitting in this lush studio of yours.
I have four chairs and a table, Mike. What are you talking about?
You have these microphones.
I have two microphones.
You have the computers.
Mike.
So this is what I'm thinking. I'm thinking that you should sponsor WorkWise.
You want me to sponsor? So what would I talk about then? What?
Well, you talk about yourself and you talk about your team and you talk about how wonderful you are. I mean, you are pretty wonderful.
I can't say that.
Well, I'll tell you what to say.
All right, go ahead.
Well, you should talk about your services. Like you do web design, that's your bread and butter.
Right.
But you do other things like, you do audiovisual services, you do videography.
Right.
You do publication design.
Yeah.
You produce podcasts and broadcasts like our own WorkWise podcast.
Right.
Right. And you do lots of great things. In fact, you've done a lot of this stuff for me. So you should talk about that.
I don't know, Mike. It sounds very self-serving to me.
I think we should up the ante though, because you do those things and they're pretty cool. But I think people should know what I really appreciate about Accent and you.
What's that? I don't even know this.
Well, I was saving it for your funeral. I mean, what will I have to say at your funeral?
Right.
Let's get to it because people don't want to listen to all this.
Yes.
So are people listening to this?
No, they've skipped out already.
Okay. Well, if they were listening, they should know that what I think Accent brings the most of, that's most valuable to me, is that everyone at Accent is just really smart. I mean, really smart people. Mm-hmm. And they're creative too.
But how does that help you?
Well, when I'm thinking about how to grow my business and how to get my message across, I need people who think analytically.
Yeah.
I need people who are smart.
Yeah.
And I need people who can help me put something together and execute it.
Yeah.
But I think it's that thinking part that Accent does better. They help me think better and more clearly about my business. So I think we should talk about that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So you should say that.
I think my mom's calling. She wants to know.
Do you hear that? Is that your mom?
She wants to know if she can sponsor after all. That's going to be way better than this.
All right. Well, go get that. I'll think about what we should say.
All right.
She's the benefit of having been both places. I wonder if colleagues at work had that same perspective and realize the need to both manage and that they can create choices like she did.
Create choices like what?
Well, like go out of the office, go to the coffee shop.
Yeah.
You know, or pick a new space in the workplace. Or maybe rearrange the workplace. Like, do they have the same sense of empowerment and choice and responsibility for picking and creating an environment for themselves?
There are a few offices that I have that I'm aware of that I've either seen or been to where they have a really isolated place where you can close the door and it's like a quiet room.
Right.
And you can concentrate. You won't be bothered. People know if someone's in that room. And if they are, they're not to be bothered.
Right.
Like, so what they're trying to do is get what you can get at home.
Right.
For a few people, for a small amount of the space. Right.
Right.
Most of the space is open office plan, very distractible or in prime spots. You can get a corner office and close the door.
It's mostly status.
Right. Or you can reserve a conference room, but someone else just reserved it. So.
And they're kind of sterile.
Well, yeah.
Like a lot of offices are just sterile places.
They are.
You know, so that makes me think about, you have a conference room you go to, but do you have a variety of kind of places? Like I was in an office a little while ago and it was one of those hipster offices, an old converted building in Alexandria, Virginia.
Yeah.
An old warehouse. And they created little spaces here and there, like you said, for a black reclining chair in a little cool room.
Yeah.
So you could adjust your perspective and be comfortable like you would at home.
Yeah.
Instead of having sterile places that are utilitarian and.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that we're starting to see places that are tailor-made for people.
And tailor-made for the way people are working. a lot of times people are working with technology that was never in view when the room was made. So where the outlets are, do I have Wi-Fi reception? Is there a place to put my laptop? Things like that also affect the space. And it's one of the differences between the space that would be designed today and one designed, you know, 20 years ago or more.
So there's that temporal difference in our perspectives. And it makes me think of the coaching work we do and how we often try to help our clients change their perspective by moving where they are, looking at different things, or changing their space.
Right. Changing their body, changing their position, being on the floor, standing up.
Yeah. And she has an awareness that she needs to do that.
Yeah. That's great intuition.
And I think, you know, my sense, and I could be totally off base with this, my sense is that because freelancers and the like have all the responsibility for being productive and all that, that they are more in tune with the need to create those things and move around and do those things that work for them. Whereas maybe folks in offices don't have that same sense of freedom or responsibility to do that. I'd be interested in talking with people in offices about that.
Yeah. One thing that she touched on was this idea of being alone, right? Being alone a lot more now than she used to be when she was in an office environment. And so I wanted to ask both of them about that. Like, what do they miss about being in an environment that was a lot more collaborative?
I miss all of the ideas that I don't have. You know. Which you get on the internet, like you can, but yeah, I miss collaboration. I miss someone else having a good idea and then me thinking about how to execute that idea, or vice versa. And I miss colleagues. I miss the team environment. I miss just having really big projects that then are, you know, everyone's focusing on a different area of accomplishing that task. When you're a freelancer, you know what needs to be done. You're approached because this thing needs to be done. So there's none of that, like, there's no management. I used to be in a management role too, or I was managing a team. There's none of that either. I'm just managing myself. And myself is not the most exciting person to manage.
So, you know, Ken, I started to feel bad for her.
Yeah.
There is this melancholy kind of seemed to overtake her. Did you notice that?
Yeah. Yeah. She misses the relational dynamic, the collaboration, all those. I love how she said, I miss all the ideas that I don't have.
The intellectual stimulation, the creativity and innovation that comes from conversation, that comes from disagreement, that comes from other people talking to you.
It comes from the spontaneous, unexpected side conversation that you didn't even know was going to happen that day. Right. It wasn't necessarily related directly, but.
Right. Yeah. And the connection, you know, the idea of working with the team and being part of and sharing in a mission, or just the sharing in doing something together, or just managing people and moving forward together with
them. But doesn't she have coworkers if she has clients? And this is one of the things that I've noticed. Yeah. When I do client work, I show up to their space, we have a meeting, and then I'm kind of feel like the meeting's over. I'm still going to work for them. I'm even going to work for them that day, for the rest of the day. And yet there's this pressure I feel to, like, okay, you're done. The meeting's done. Bye. See you later.
You plugged in and then I'll plug out and go away.
Yeah. And I almost felt like, if that person or a group would create a space for the freelancers when they're there, then they would gain something that they wouldn't otherwise gain by just only being present when there's an official meeting.
Yeah. And I think that has everything to do, maybe not everything, a lot to do with how internal folks see people from the outside. They're not us.
Yeah.
They're someone to come in and use. And I don't know if they realize that people on the outside want to connect and be part of, and even if it's temporary for a while.
And that the work would be better for it, I guess is what I want to say.
And there would be a richness to the process of working and the relationships and there'd be more creativity out of it. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And so with that, there's another piece. That's why I backed off and said it doesn't have everything to do with it. That tells me that as an independent agent or a consultant or whatever version you are, that there's a skill or approach
yes.
that invites people to work with yes. and engage with you and you to engage with them so that it creates that. You're not waiting for them to create that thing.
Right.
But you go in and their experience with you is that you create that.
Yes. And what I've seen is that you can actually use your tools to help accomplish that.
Right.
So an example would be, if I wanted to show you something that you hired me to do, instead of me having a copy and you having a copy,
right.
I could just have one copy yeah. and we would have to sit together in such a right. way that we're both facing the document mm-hmm. and we'd both have a pen. We'd both be marking things up or right. a screen, a computer screen. Yeah. Let's both look at the same screen, literally right. the same screen,
right.
which puts us in a geography of being side by side facing this thing, both working at it, both working right. in it, or maybe a triangle where you're one
right.
apex, I'm one apex. And then the yeah. computer, there's things you can do. I think to put your physical environment in such a way that it actually fosters the kind of interaction
you're looking for
that brings about that kind of collaboration, that kind of physically says what you want to emotionally and relationally say, yeah. which is that we're together, we're on right. this, we're a team.
Right. And I think there's communication stuff too, which says, let's look at this together. Let's work on this together. But there, I think there's a dilemma there in some places where people expect folks on the outside to come in and delivered the perfect thing because we hired you
yeah, right.
to be the perfect expert. And that's right. not really what we're hiring people for.
Well, I think that you can set those expectations. Like yeah. we've tried to do that with our company. There's a page actually about that on our website that talks about how we work.
Right.
And it says that we're trying to actually avoid the extremes. One extreme is you just hire us for our expertise. We go away, do the work right. and bring it. Right?
Right.
The other extreme is that you tell us exactly what to do and we just do it. So right. we're just kind of brainless, you know, implementers.
Right. Yeah.
And we call it that coactive creativity in the middle right. where we're both bringing what we have to offer.
Right.
We're both in it together and we're making the creativity happen between us and among
right.
us, as opposed to go away and be creative yeah. and come back and give a solution.
Yeah. And Peter Block wrote a couple of books on consulting years ago, and he kind of defined those things too. He said, you know, one extreme, you're the expert
yeah.
and everything perfect and all responsibility is on you.
Yeah.
Right. At the other extreme, you're a pair of hands where you just do what you're told to do.
Yeah.
And then there's this ground in between where you're a partner with people.
Yes.
And so there's not just, but creating that sense of partnership, it is the responsibility, it seems, of the person coming in.
Yeah.
Rather than the person, yeah. So like what you're doing. Yeah.
And you have to see if they're open to it, right?
Right.
Not everyone
right.
wants that.
They want a pair of hands or they yeah. want the expert.
So it's good to know that going in.
Right.
And that can be part of the yeah. alliance that you design with them.
Yeah. And so maybe Megan has some. Was that Megan or April? I lost track.
That was Megan.
Megan. She has some maybe work to do on figuring out how to do that to get more of what she's seeking.
It's hard. We've been at it for years, and yeah. we have a lot of work to do.
yeah.
So I asked April the same question about being alone
okay.
and about working with others. And I was curious what she, especially because a writer, you know, yeah. you think of a writer
as the same.
Working alone a lot.
Don't they work alone?
Well, we'll find out. Here
okay.
she is.
It was very surprising to me that I didn't feel lonely doing this job. And I think that that has two main reasons. One is that my writing is very social. And I mean that it's always about people. It's about someone's project. It's that I'm interviewing someone. It's that I'm ghostwriting for someone. It's me going to an event and reporting on it. It's always about people in some way and me expressing their story. So I think that the same way that, there's this famous quote, and I forget who it's by, but it's one of my favorite quotes about writing, which is, the writer wrote alone and the reader read alone and they were alone together. And I feel that every day with what I do, that I am immersed in these stories, I'm immersed in my experience of beholding them and trying to translate them for other people. And that is a lot of the same sensation that I feel when I'm with someone in person or with a group in person. So the type of writing I do is a social type of writing, I would say. And the second thing is that I think I am less of an extreme extrovert than I have been thinking for the last 20-something years, for that same reason that I've pushed myself into all these really adventurous situations in the name of getting good stories, in the name of having an interesting life and having great experiences, and it's been great. But now that I'm spending a lot more time alone and liking it, I'm thinking, maybe I don't need all that external stimulation that I was really foisting myself into.
So do you feel like you're peering into her self-development? Well, that's
what I love about April's perspective here. She just really pulls back the curtain here. Yeah. And she has a lot of insight. She's obviously thought a lot about her experience. She's very introspective, and she's revealing a lot about what it's like to be this kind of writer.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, listening to this and to both Megan and April, actually, is, you know, they're doing a lot of thinking and self-reflecting. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if there's something about the challenges of this kind of lifestyle, and maybe even contrasted with what's going on around them in the world or what the norms have been, that's causing them to kind of grow and develop and to think about it a lot.
Well, I have to say, as someone who's been to New York many times for work, the experience of going into the city, it really fosters this kind of reflection. I mean, I go into the city and I feel like I have to put my protection on. Because the city is loud, it's big, it's crowded, there's lots of people. My experience is being on the street and on the subway and on the bus, and it's very hustle bustle. And it kind of, my natural response is to put on earphones, listen to something else, go into my little cocoon and in my little world that I create for myself when I'm there. And that's a very reflective space. It's an internal space.
So you're bombarded with lots of different things and different experiences or possibilities and people and things.
Stimulation, yes.
That you put a shell on a little bit, and then you reflect on how this affects you and what it means for you.
Right, because the person I'm standing next to, I'm never going to see again.
Right.
And I'm going to see tens of thousands of people between the morning and the evening.
So maybe this isn't the experience of having to be a freelancer or an independent person so much as it might be as being the hubbub of a city trying to make it on your own.
Yeah. I think that's part of it. I think that's part of it. It promotes a certain kind of reflection. I'm not saying you can't be reflective in the prairie, but that would be a different kind. I think it promotes a different kind of reflection. There's, you know,
She commented on her extroversion.
Yes.
And she said, you know, maybe I'm not as extroverted as I thought I was.
Right, because she's thriving in this solitary activity.
Right. But she also said, come on now, like, she's spending all that time talking to people.
She is. She calls it social writing, right?
Right.
Yeah. Going to an event, interviewing people. These are parts of the writing task. But certainly not the whole of it.
So what's a person who's listening to this our podcast and our conversation here take away from what she's saying here? What's the lesson from here? Is it just New York's cool, or what?
I think one of the lessons is that no matter who you are, whether extreme this or extreme that, you know, there are choices that you can make as an independent person that can help shape the job and the career around your strengths and around your natural bent and around who you are.
So it's kind of like just another dimension to the space issue. You can choose things to work, but there's choosing ways of working and how you do things to fulfill your needs, to pique your interest.
Or to maximize your strengths and your impact in the world.
Yeah. She's not sitting around going to the library, researching things, reading and then writing. She's going around to talk to people.
She is.
And so it's not necessarily a solitary as. Yeah.
And even when she's by herself at her standing desk writing for 4 hours in a row, she sees that as serving and connecting with the people.
Yeah.
We're alone together.
Yeah. There is something about being the independent agent where I think we heard earlier that you're not part of the team, but you're serving people. You're kind of separated, but you're serving.
You're half in, half out.
Yeah, and I wonder if that is part of the blood, is wanting the variety, but also knowing that you're fulfilling a need for somebody, and that's what's driving you. Is it very mission-minded work, perhaps? I'm not sure. I don't know. It just seems different to me. But then I guess there's freelance engineers and photographers, sure, and that are into their art.
Right.
And maybe it's the work itself that's driving them, right, as opposed to helping somebody with something. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I've heard people say, you know, when asked, like if you talk to a high school kid who's, right, about to graduate, you say, what do you want to do with your life? And they'll say, oh, I want to be a doctor or a nurse or something, right, like that. You say, why? And they'll say, because I really like helping people.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a really stupid reason to be a doctor.
Right.
It's a great reason to have a job, because it turns out that all the jobs that you could possibly have are there to help people in some way, right?
And if you see it that way.
Well, but you'll become to see it that way, right, I think, especially as an independent worker, right, because what you realize, yeah, if you're not helping people, no one's paying you for anything.
What's
if
the
no
value?
One's paying you for anything, right, you're not working.
Right. But you, as a free agent, you see that. I don't think, yes, you see that as clearly when you're employed by somebody, especially if you're in a big organization.
Right.
Because there you said, my job is to do this and accomplish this thing.
Well, then I have this question for you, Mr. Organizational Development Guy.
Okay.
Who's working with those corporations.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm wondering what they need to learn that the, yeah, independent professionals can teach them about work in this regard.
I think that's it. Is that, you know, we talk about, you know, a few years ago, the big idea that of internal customer service started to be big, where you are actually serving somebody. Your work product, somebody else uses.
Yeah.
And if it's going to be valuable to them, you have to design it for them to their specs and work with them in a way that's conducive to their needs, right? And so that was a big deal, but I think it's lost on Americans. And I talk about this a lot, actually, is that who are our heroes? They're not people who serve. They're people who conquer individually. It's the guy with the big S on his chest that can beat anybody down. Mm-hmm. And we see this on our TV shows. That's a whole other topic. But
sounds like you still have some work to do.
Yeah. And the TV shows aren't helping me any.
Well, speaking of TV, the internet is taking over our entertainment,
yep,
and our visual attention.
Yeah.
And it's no different at work, where the same computer that you use to get your research done is the same screen that you're looking at to check Facebook or watch YouTube videos or just get distracted with, right, social media, whatever. And I asked April about that,
oh,
actually.
You did?
And here's what she said.
Wow.
Well, a variety of things. I feel very beholden to my clients. I really want to do my best work for them. I really want to do what they need. And some of that is doing it in a timely fashion. I feel just as obliged to my clients now as I did to any boss I've had, so that's a big motivator. I'm also not probably, it seems, I guess, as susceptible to a lot of online bait as a lot of people I know. I'm not a big internet person in a lot of ways. I love to use email, I love to be able to research things, but I don't tend to have the sort of rabbit hole syndrome of clicking on one thing after another. The thing that'll get me is if I'm working on something that I find really tedious, it's really easy to creep away and go look at something. Or the other time is when there's some personal thing that I have to research that is clawing at the back of my mind, like we're house hunting right now. So the temptation is very strong if I'm working on something that's not particularly absorbing to say, what if I just go over to Street Easy for a few minutes and look up any new houses that might have come on the market, whatever. So, and sometimes I do that, but I try to do it. I'll say, okay, then take a 5-minute break and do that, and then you got to get back to work. And that's typically works. Or I'll say, okay, just finish this part and then take a break, or finish this piece and take a break, or something like that. And typically I can keep it under control.
I love the way she talks to herself. Did you notice that? Like, I say to myself, okay, I do this for 5 minutes. And then, so there's like this conversation where she's managing herself.
Yeah.
She's got this self-talk going, which is like, you know, you might expect a manager to give you that kind of insight if you were just a doer, a worker.
Right. Yeah. So it's using the executive processes in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is, you know, what you just said, it goes back to like, you know, theory X and theory Y management. Theory X says, well, the boss has to tell you to control you and plan for you and help you make the decisions and direct your path. And what you're noticing is she's saying, no, I do this. I have to do this. And I think I just want to take that clip and I want to share it with every old school manager out there. And there are tons of them. Because that's one of the things, you know, we have a lot of telework these days, right? These worlds blend. We have remote workers and teleworkers. And the big question is, oh, can I trust my people to be responsible at home and not be playing? And but somehow we trust consultants who aren't in our presence to do the work. And I think there's, I'm double-minded about this. I'm vexed because on one hand, you know, people do the work. They are beholden to their customers, mm-hmm. and they're beholden to themselves because they have a sense of pride in their work, and mm-hmm. they want to do things, and that's true. But we seem to imbue consultants and independent agents and free agents and contractors with that capacity very often, but not our own employees. At the same time, we do see people at work who don't feel that same beholdenness at work, you know. But if they don't do it in the workplace, they're not going to do it at home.
Yeah,
and that's the measure. I have a friend who's a telework queen. We call her, and she always says that telework or remote working remotely reveals problems, doesn't cause them, right? Mm. And so, but this what she's saying here is I'm beholden to the client and to me to get things done. That's what keeps me focused.
Yeah. Yeah. And she takes her work seriously.
Message. Yeah.
So it turns out that there's a big difference, I think, or maybe there's not, we'll find out, between a freelancer and employee. We've been kind of teasing this out, and the more we look at it, we're seeing how nuanced it is. I'm interested in the effect that this kind of work has on the worker. Like, what does it do to their soul?
The soul.
Yeah.
So tell me more what you mean by that.
Well, there's the mechanical part of it, which I think is external. Like, oh, I either clock in over here or I manage myself over there, right? But what is the impact down deep on the person?
Their personhood, their identity.
Yes.
Who they think they are.
Yes. How they see themselves and how other people see them too.
Yeah.
I don't think everyone would answer this way, but I am like a stayer. And I like consistency. I dig in deep. I've been in New York for 11 years. And I'm not the kind of person to jump from career to career every couple of years because of, I want to try something new. I don't think that I'm like that. I like what being someplace for a long time does for me and does for an environment. So for my soul, it's exciting because it has forced me to let go of control. Like when you're in a stable situation for a long time, it feels more in control. When you're in short-term situations, you just don't know what's around the next corner. And that has been hard, but also good, because none of us are in control of our lives. It's just sometimes we're in a setting that makes it feel like we are. So I've been reminded that I'm not.
You know, it sounds like she's contradicting herself.
Yeah, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You can hear the internal conflict.
Yeah, but she's really not. What she's doing is she's learning and growing through challenge, right? She says, you know, I'm a stayer. I like stability. I like predictability. I like to be in control. And that's good for my soul.
Yeah.
But as a freelancer, I don't have those things. So it's good for my soul. Right?
And what's interesting is to see how she would respond if someone came along and said, I have a really stable full-time job for you.
Yeah.
Would you like that?
Yeah.
And how she would respond, because I think that at the same time she says, I'm a stayer, I want the whole environment thing, the role it has, the impact it has on me and the environment and all that. I think she's also saying, I have embraced the adventuresome side of this arrangement, and I do appreciate some of the freedom and the autonomy.
Well, and there's also an emptiness in this sense of control she's realizing.
Yeah, it's like, not all that
she's
control.
She's not really in control.
Yeah.
And holding on to that makes no sense, and she's going so there is no control, and I'm going to grow and be a better person and experience more life if I put myself in situations where I'm not comfortable and where I have to deal with the reality that I'm not in fact in control and become the peace with that. And like, so it sounds like she's a young lady.
Is she would not want to work with that kind of person? I ask you. I mean, that's a very mature young person, isn't it?
Well, you know, I'm listening to these two young ladies and I'm thinking I have a lot to learn from them. You know, I mean, I really am.
Yeah.
Because you know, I am not far, you know, my business is not far from where they are.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I'm as reflective as they are.
Right.
And aware of these things. And so I'm like, I want to learn from these ladies.
Yeah. Well, here's something you can learn from April. I asked her about the differences between freelancing and a full-time job. And she talks about the lifestyle.
The structure, maybe the biggest thing, the non-financial biggest thing, is the lack of a predetermined path. So if you're working in an organization, again, there's, you know, you're part of a whole and you have a job title and you have probably people above you and maybe people below you and whatever, but you get a sense of somewhere you could aspire to if you want to move ahead or to the side or whatever, but there's a map there already and you can, you know where you are on the map and you can assess where you want to be elsewhere on the map and work toward that. But when you're on your own, there's absolutely nothing. You're just in a void and you determine everything. So that's the blessing and sometimes the liability is, you know, somebody like me, I'm very just into following my bliss kind of life path and it's served me really well and I'm generally at peace with it. But in a situation like this, I've definitely had moments and sometimes days or stretch of days in the last couple of years where I think, what am I just spinning my wheels here? You know, because I'm not so good at making a goal and going for it. I'm better at either following just what's interesting to me at that time or seeing somebody's goal that's already laid out and saying, oh, I like that goal, I'm gonna go for that. So the sense of, it's not like flounderingness or whatever, but just the landscape is bare when you get there and you have to build it up as the freelancer. So for some people that works great. And a lot of freelancers I talk to are people who despise having a boss. They can't work with other people. They're this kind of independent, bullheaded, whatever. And it's so funny because that doesn't apply to me. I always liked my jobs. I always liked my bosses. I had great coworkers. You know, I never had a beef with working 9 to 5 or working with other people. I just wanted to try this too. But I have found that that's periodically been something of a frustration is thinking, where am I going with this? And God, in addition to actually working, I have to choose, I have to think about and commit to a whole plan and trajectory that's not laid out for me.
So again, we see managing yourself here, but I like what she said, that there's this bare landscape and I have to build it up. It seems like she has to not only navigate the map, but build the map that can be navigated.
Right. Yeah. So it's like playing Civilization.
Yeah. Right.
Hey, it's not there for you. So you have to do it. And that kind of, that goes back to the dictate, I think, of know thyself.
Mm.
Right. So, and why are you in this and how does this match up with what's needed? You know, so, doing a lot of independents and consultants and new business owners get into the work because they like the work. They can do that.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't know, they don't realize that how much of the work is, you know, catching it first.
Yeah, right.
And and having a plan and structuring your time and all the struggles with that. And she's saying, I struggle with these things. And so,
yeah,
you know, it doesn't mean don't do it, I don't think.
Yeah.
I think it means you need to find a way to cope and manage that stuff. And
so it's no wonder then that coaching is taking off as a profession because people like this don't have a manager, they don't have a boss, they don't have a structure, they're a little, and they're like, and the world is basically saying to them, well, what do you want?
Right.
And to be able to create that.
To create yourself.
Yeah.
To create your world and give it to the world and impose it on the world.
Right. And yet how much of yourself can you really create? Or is it more like find? And
right.
Create. There's some kind of combination of discovery and creation there.
And I think it goes back to, you know, part of the relationships we talked about earlier is that no one stands alone.
Yeah.
We like to pretend people stand alone. But when you're a free agent or a small contractor or, you know, you build and put people around you to fulfill certain functions or to do things for you. And that's part of creating your world. You're taking that block, that building or that water infrastructure and civilization, and you're going plop, and I'm creating that. And yeah. But it takes the realization you have to do that and the gumption in finding it. So there's, you're creating something.
So what does a person like April need then to do that well?
Yeah. You know, I think that it's, you know, it's the, you know, the e-myth kind of thing of working on your business.
Yeah.
Not to build just your business. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also, I think that for me, it's those drives to create the world you're going to live in, you know? So, you know, and when I do a lot of training, and there's a point in my career, early in my career, where it was intimidating to go in and talk to people. And like, I felt like this was their world. Mm. And then I realized one day, no, when they walk into that training room, they've walked into my world.
Yeah.
And I'm going to create this. I'm going to create their experience.
Yeah.
And I think it's the same thing for April. It's, you know what? I'm going to create this world that I'm living in, and the rules and the people and the systems. And I'm going to impose that and offer it, rather than just me try to plug into things. And I think that's what's necessary.
Or maybe we could say co-create it, because it seems to me that the client's needs and desires are very much a part of this work.
Yeah.
That we don't want to just say, take it or leave it. We actually want to like come together and create in between us something that really will work for both of us.
And this is harks back to a conversation before, but I think when I say impose it, it means that I'm bringing the co-create with me.
Yeah.
I'm not making that other person responsible for co-creating.
Yeah.
I'm creating the climate and structure and systems and the desire and the of making us co-create it.
Yeah.
And I'm responsible for making it happen so we can co-create this
yes.
thing.
Yes. Right? Yes. Good.
And I think that's what the freelancer has to do.
All right. Well, we got to wrap this up.
Right,
I'm going to end with one more question.
Okay.
And I just wanted to ask these two people, like, what advice would they have for someone who is considering it? And especially maybe a younger person. Is this the smart thing to do coming out of college?
Oh.
You know, what do you what's your take on that? Here's what they had to say.
Yeah, wait, before we do this.
Yeah.
Do you have opinions on this?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So do I. So let's hear what these young ladies have to say and see if they're smart like we are.
My hunch, my sort of somewhat naive hunch, is that straight out of college you shouldn't go into freelancing for a couple of reasons. One, it would behoove you to have a high level of accountability and people who are a lot more experienced than you, watching over you, coaching you, reminding you of everything that you don't know, which is not what happens when you're in college. I was routinely severely humbled after college because I went to a school that inflated people's egos and, you know, didn't actually give us that many skills as wonderful of a place as it was. When I entered the professional world, I quickly knew that, like, I don't know that much. I have a lot to learn. So I don't think you should freelance right away. For that reason, right out of college. I mean, it really depends on your skill, you know, like developer, there's all kinds of people who have skills that are probably already very marketable, but my skills were helped by working on a team first. I also think that unless you have a pretty big network of people committed to working alongside you, freelancing is going to be hard. You know, you need colleagues, you need people who are doing things completely different from you, who need your skills, and people who are doing the exact same thing as you to remind you of how you need to improve. At the same time, freelancing can be good when you're young because that's when you want flexibility, so you can travel or whatever.
I didn't realize how much of my daily identity I was pinning on and entwining with my professional titles and places within the organization and goals and the perception of what I was doing by other people. And to say now that I'm a freelancer is a different kind of identity than it is to say I work for XYZ. In general, I like it. I know that some people don't take me as seriously, so if you're concerned about that, you need to have a way to reconcile it or think through it or whatever, feel through it. I enjoy saying now that I'm a writer, which is great, and I, you know, is fun, and it's a goal that I feel like I've reached. But that's a big one that, again, I think is something you could maybe tell someone in a bullet point, but they have to really experience it. But I tend to think that if you are curious about doing it, you should just give it a shot. I mean, you know, just have some money in the bank and whatever, do your best and try it for a year. And if you utterly fail, just go back to work for somebody. It's not the biggest deal. You know, I would encourage anyone to give it a try who's keen to find out.
I thought it was interesting that Megan brought up something that I see a lot in millennials.
Yeah. Yes, you did.
There is a dangerous combination of being told for 18 years or 22 years coming out of school that how amazing you are, combined with a real lack of knowledge, experience, and wisdom that you get from years of working.
And I'll up your ante on that. So it gets confusing because you're told that, right? And then she said, I was humbled.
Yes.
Badly.
Yeah.
In a number of ways. But imagine how confusing it is when you are at once humbled and then also see that your skills and capabilities in some areas are far beyond these older colleagues you have with you. So you're getting it. It's confusing.
Yes. You're both sharper, smarter, and more savvy in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
And you're also a complete novice.
Right.
In others.
What do you think? Do you agree with Megan? Do you think a person ought not try it, and why?
I did it right out of college, right? Yeah. I was self-employed when I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
So in my situation, I was doing IT consulting because the skills were so marketable and
right.
There was so much demand that that a young person who was really good at it could be a consultant at that early age and still offer a lot. No, I don't think it's a smart move for most people because most people are not in that situation. And I agree with Megan, you would benefit from having mentoring, oversight, accountability, structure, all the stuff that a work environment gives you. And in some ways it protects you.
Well, and things you only learn from being there, right?
Yeah.
You've never been in that situation before.
Right.
And the best teacher is experience.
And most of the people you're going to consult with later are going to be in some kind of situation
right.
that will help you with. So,
well, and you have to understand what they're dealing with.
Yes. Yeah. So I probably wouldn't, you know, it depends on the situation, but I wouldn't recommend it for most people. How about you?
Oh my gosh. No. I mean, so I think you were in a highly unique setting. So I'm comfortable saying no. Like, yeah, there are exceptions and you were one of them.
Yeah.
But the general rule, no, it's a bad idea. You don't understand what people are dealing with. You don't understand the world yet. You have some good learning and knowledge and skills, and they're valuable. But, you know, you don't understand. It's kind of like being taught to swim on land and then being thrown in a pool suddenly after college graduation and say, now swim.
Yeah.
Right? So I think it's very unwise. And I think Megan is wise to say no to people. Like, that's not a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we have even more from these ladies to learn.
Yes.
And but we're out of time for today.
Yeah.
So what have you taken from that? What are the highlights for you?
You know, I think the highlights for me have been how much the experience challenges people.
Yeah.
And I think the highlights for me are hearing the lessons around self-awareness and self-management and figuring all that stuff out, and the awareness of how important their relationships are in so many ways.
Yeah.
That's what I'm taking out of it. How about you? How about you?
I'm taking away that work is so big in terms of a force in our lives. It shapes so much. And the challenges, as you say, are so great that our response to those challenges may very well be the thing that that shapes the future of our lives
right.
when we're older. That the things that we do in these early years in our 20s and 30s in work could very well produce the muscles that we use for the rest of our careers.
And that's very true. And so that means being a good steward of that time.
Yes.
And having probably good mentors and people to guide
invest
you.
Invest well now in getting those things right.
Mm,
and it'll pay big dividends.
Yeah. That's a good word, Ken. All right, so we'll talk next time about more with April and Megan.
That's right.
Fantastic.
All right, thanks, Mike.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to WorkWise. If you'd like more information about this podcast, head over to creativitylabs.us. For more on Michael Boyes, head over to credoconsulting.us. And if you're interested more about Accent Interactive, you can visit us at accentinteractive.com.